Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. As season four comes to a close, we've looked at some amazing movies in the year 2010. But when you look at the year as a whole, there's one defining trend: franchises, and remakes intended to launch franchises again. In a previous episode, Cam talked about how 2008's economic disaster caused Hollywood to buy up all the IP. And in 2010, we're seeing the results of that. Even the adaptation of the board game was something we'd see a lot of. We almost got an actual Hungry Hungry Hippos movie, not just a punchline in a Lord and Miller sitcom. Now, today, we're going to look at two movies that failed to reboot their franchises despite box office success, arguably. Alicia, we both know reboot booms aren't a new thing, and Hollywood isn't out of ideas. But Cam, what should we know about the reboot slash adaptation slash franchise boom of the last year of the 2000s? It's ridiculous when you look. You've got like Harry Potter and like Percy Jackson. It's crazy.
But I think we'll be getting to this era is where we start seeing what is now referred to as legacy sequels, and like especially okay. The nascent version of that, though. Yeah, I'm sure there's actually a great Letterboxd list that I feel like would have the Alicia stuff where she's like, you know, that Harold Lloyd was in a legacy sequel, blah blah blah. And I mean, there are obviously big ones. The 80s tried it as well, like Psycho 2 was a very successful legacy mm-hmm. sequel. And so these ones, they're a little defined better. The best, weirdly, legacy sequel movie to talk about legacy sequels is the latest Scream. It's not necessarily my favorite movie, but they discuss it, where it's like, you bring back old characters, you're trying to, like, reconnect. And I also think another part of it is this weird idea that you kind of see in Predators, where you are maybe ignoring other sequels. Like, this might be, you might be rejigging the continuity. And I think you see the lead up of this with stuff like Superman Returns, which is like a sequel to Superman 2, ignoring 3 and 4. And I think you're also seeing, but along the way, like you would say, there's Sylvester Stallone, our friend from The Expendables, earlier, right before 2010.
Our friend.
I guess so.
Friend of the show, Sylvester Stallone.
Sure.
You know what? From the way he talks about his fans, we are all his
friends.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm number one Stallone fan. Rocky franchise is my favorite franchise.
Just great. I think it was him on an episode of Solar Opposites. Maybe not. Somebody at least making fun of him. Yeah, anyway, he had Rambo, the then reboot of Rambo, which I believe has been rebooted since, and Rocky Balboa, which of course got rebooted again with Creed, a more successful legacy sequel. And then Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was in 2008, which I think in a lot of ways presages these as well, because it tried to put Shia LaBeouf, who of course is also in Wall Street Money Never Sleeps in 2010, as the also reboot younger version. So yeah, it's a weird thing where it kind of, it's always been happening, you know, the Color of Money, Halloween H2O, The Rage, Carrie 2. I think even that Samuel Jackson Shaft considers that he's like the nephew of the original Shaft. So they've been happening, but for some reason, I think 2010, you have this big wad of them, and from here on out, this is how you create a sequel reboot. And the thing is, like, I think they're often seen as this boondoggle, but if you think of Creed and you think of Jurassic World, those are incredibly successful. And yeah, like going back to Psycho 2, that was incredibly successful, and there's multiple sequels to that sequel.
I won't talk about Jurassic World because, I try not to use this, but I do like the term suckwell. We're at the point where not only is it there to like suck all of your money, it's just also not very good, right? And I think the issue I have with a lot of the 2010 reboots is that they haven't quite found the balance between the fan service, because now the internet is there, and creating a new world that people can get into. Mm. And I think we're going to see that with one of our films today.
Oh, yeah. I think that there's also this 80s mania, which kind of peaks. I would say kind of peaks, dies, gets, you know, pastiche to death with like Stranger Things in 2016. But I think that they were just mining everything from the 80s. And sometimes they were mining, for instance, in one of these films, a existing failure. Like, why choose to go back to the mines of a flop? Like, what are you talking about?
That person would also go on to direct the new Mavericks. So,
yeah,
you know,
though arguably you can read all sorts of conspiracy theories as to whether or not Joseph Kosinski actually directed Top Gun Maverick. But maybe he's the king of legacy sequels. It's tough to tell. And I do think that both of these movies we're going to talk about really laid the track for what would happen and be iterated better or worse.
Interesting. So, Alicia, how is this not new? Like, why does Hollywood keep coming back to these things in these periods?
I mean, money.
Yeah.
And it goes back to the gold diggers, right? Like, literally, if you think about in the 30s, height of the Depression, yet Hollywood, MGM especially, are kind of on top. You know, you had the gold diggers of 29. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, okay, what are we going to do next? Gold diggers in 1930? Gold diggers in 1931? Gold diggers in 1932?
47 different versions of A Star is Born? Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, A Star is Born is a great example. Although even there, you know, I think that's a funny franchise because it's not a franchise, it's IP. But so many people think the Streisand is the original, not knowing that then there's a Garland. And then the Garland people don't know that there's one from the 30s that is kind of, for me, the best. It's always been there. It's been there since the silent era when copyright was different than how we know it today. And you could rip off, you know, A Trip to the Moon got plagiarized and that's why you had studios come up with their logos that they would put in the corner of every single frame so that you couldn't steal their photography and put your own title cards on it and then call it your own film. Like this goes back to the inception of film.
Well, I think feel like Inception is the perfect way for us to get into our first film. So with its cutting edge technology and a dreamy baby Jeff Bridges in the lead role, Disney was sure to have a hit on its hands with 1982's Tron. It was, of course, a notorious flop. Give a listen to one of our many episodes about Dark Age Disney. It did, however, develop a cult following, and by 2010, CGI had advanced to the point that not only could the world of Tron be really cool, we could also present you a youngified Jeff Bridges. So, were people begging for a sequel to Tron? Did it finally give Disney the Tron rumpf they craved? Sorry, it's the last episode. I had to end on that. I couldn't help myself. Let's get into it. Cam, do you want to give us a little plot summary on this one?
Sure. I think it depends on what a Tron rumpf is. It might
rumpf.
Have. Yeah. So Tron Legacy throws out actually quite a lot of the original Tron. It involves Kevin Flynn, the Jeff Bridges character from the original film. It starts off with him kind of describing his adventures from the original film, being sucked into the grid, this computer, defeating the master control, to his son Sam. Then he mysteriously disappears. He has, it's worth saying, also successfully, the first film is all about him defending that he invented all these computer games, and he successfully did and took over NCOM, the company that was evil in the first movie. So now then, you know, his son, sad, his dad is gone. Smash cut two. Now his son is hunk Garrett Hedlund, being real bad. I don't know. They shave off his facial hair, what he has going for him, and make him just a real bland hero. But he's kind of a cool tech bro, extreme sports enthusiast, and he ends up, through various machinations, including also Bruce Bockleitner returning as Alan Bradley, helping him out. He ends up, what really matters is he gets sucked into a computer. He finds out Kevin, his father, Jeff Bridges, has been in the computer for these past 15 years, and he is fighting a version of himself, Clue. Clue was also the version of him in the old movie, but this is a different Clue. It's a different computer. And he ends up meeting Cora, who is a... Oh my God, I can't even get into it. Kevin Flynn made a computer that made spontaneous computer people. There was a holocaust of sorts of these computer people run by Clue. He saved Cora. Sam's just trying to get out of there and reconnect with his father. They're trying to fight Clue. They're trying to seemingly inject Cora into the real world for reasons unknown.
none of this matters. None That's of this matters. So funny. Yeah. None of that plot matters.
And I didn't even get to any of the good characters.
No, I know. And neither does the fact that the entire thing that Clue is trying to enter the real world is like, but none of this is going to work. Like, your reality is different from that.
Yeah, that's the thing, too. It's like, would you not, like, if you came out, would you not just be electricity or some shit? Like, that's the thing.
That's what I would presume.
I tried to.
I think that's what Lawnmower Man is about, right?
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Tron, Lawnmower Man.
Isn't Lawnmower Man also trying to, like, impregnate a woman so they can have a baby? Like, yeah, I think that there's now and again, quite often when computers want to come into the real world, they're trying to put themselves in a baby, which makes more sense.
I don't know. I like the one that's got the guy who played Harold from Twin Peaks and Bud Cort as a computer that's trying to rule his life. And I am, have you seen this movie?
I don't remember that one.
Oh my God, it's wonderful. Anyway, it's a rom-com. It's great. I'll send you guys a link for it. Okay. I'll look it up and insert it. But that one's fun. That one's like computer comes into the real world, voiced by Bud Cort. It's great.
I mean, there's a lot of, once again, quickly, just because we had a little time this morning, turned on while I had my breakfast, old Tron, and forgot that, like, yeah, the plot makes a lot more sense. It's a lot, there's like a Wizard of Oz kind of element, because everyone in the computer has an outside the computer person, and like a lot of what the computer is doing is actually evil outside as well, and then also the fact that it's like religious, like it's users versus, it's very much, the interesting thing is I also wonder how much Tron Legacy got kind of scooped by Reboot. Because I feel like Reboot is very much like the good sequel to Tron, almost. Yeah.
Oh, I'm with you.
You get a sense with this that this isn't the film they set out to make. Because why is Cillian Murphy in this film as a villain for 25 seconds? Yeah. He clearly has a much larger role that was completely... And I haven't seen any writing on this. Maybe you have it, Becky. What is going on?
Because they're setting up sequels.
Yeah.
That's what's happening.
That's it,
100%. There was an investment in this. It was going to be an enormous hit, an enormous franchise. And so from the very beginning, it's the same thing they did with Marvel. Well, they didn't own Marvel then, but it's the same thing that happened with Marvel, where like characters show up. We're like, oh my God, it's going to become blank. And there, it's those little Easter eggs. He's in the sequels.
Yeah. So it's like a weird.
That makes sense.
There's a lot. And it is weird. Yeah. Again, there is no like real world bad guy per se. It's kind of unusual. And then also the fact that it's like, I don't know, the ending of this also, you're just like, what's the what?
I do want to just signal that I didn't grow up. I think I have memories of Tron existing in my childhood because it was in pop culture. Mm-hmm. Even if it was a failure, you know, it was an instant cult classic, but also like popular culture talked about all the time, whether that was The Simpsons. But when I sat down as an adult, and I was very lucky because I do think this still exists, but Disney has one 70mm print left of Tron, the original Tron. And they showed it at TIFF. And, you know, I was like, oh, they showed it like a matinee on a weekday during March break for kids, which I was like, that's not how we schedule films, folks. But I came down with my lunch and like watched Tron with like 10 other people. Wow. Seeing that in 70 with surround sound, and it was a 70 print that contained an incredible soundtrack that would have been cutting edge in 82.
Yeah.
Got it. Like, I got what they were trying to do in 82 with Disney and animation. And it's sad because I think people can't experience Tron the way it was meant to be experienced. And I'm not sure the filmmakers who made Tron Legacy experienced Tron the way it was meant to be experienced because they miscalculated.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We talked about Joseph Kosinski, and he's very much just like a work for hire. I think he has a good background for it. But the thing is, he was kind of like, this is his first movie. He worked in video games and advertising. He was quite, his movie Oblivion, the one that follows this, was quite hot, and he was prepping Oblivion, and I think Disney was very interested in him doing either The Black Hole or Tron, and they were kind of making him choose between. And he chose Tron, but it really was up to the screenwriters, because he's like, oh, I didn't really care for Tron. So it's interesting because he has this background of architecture and stuff.
Which works. That actually works, I think.
I don't know. It still doesn't look good, though, compared to the old one.
I think
it
does. A lot of scenes. In moments. I think it's way too dark
Movie. Yeah.
But I want to come back to the screenwriters just for a second here, because I think a lot of the blame does land on them because they don't like Tron either.
Oh, I thought that they did.
Well, what are they doing at the table then?
Yeah. So this is Edward Kistis and Adam Horowitz, whose names might sound familiar because they do a bunch of Disney stuff. The issue becomes is that they don't understand the world and it's too complex for just one film. And they're not doing a thing which a lot of things which they know they're going to have a franchise is they keep the origin story nice and simple. They set up a couple little building blocks and then they move on to the next one where the world gets more and more complex. That doesn't happen here. Here, they're just like, here is everything and like 9 different plot lines and another story. And there's just too much
going on.
Hard,
though, because, and I'm going to disagree a bit with Cam, I think there's certain sequences, at least, of this film that look incredible. I did go see this in theaters. I saw it in 3D. I'm not a huge, even back in 2010, not a big fan of 3D in a cinema, usually because the bulb has to be so much dimmer that you're losing the quality of the picture. I think there's scenes of this, especially in the end of the line club, is that what it's called? Mm. The club that
Michael Sheen,
you know, with playing Zeus and some of the stuff with the three muses. And I think it's stunning. Like, absolutely. I'm all there for Daft Punk. I love that Daft Punk, who did the soundtrack for this and appear as themselves in their helmets at this club.
Bossed around by David Bowie, Michael Sheen.
It's funny, but what doesn't make sense is that for 1982, Tron was quite cutting edge in how it discussed things like virtual reality that were kind of, you know, new in its inception and becoming
the
commonplace
idea of
and
an
video
avatar
games and
was completely
avatars,
unknown, right?
Pixelization, digitization, the idea of like not every family had a home gaming system in 1982. This was just starting to happen. So where is that commentary for 2010?
Yeah, it's
like they're still stuck in the 80s and it's like there's a scene where Jeff Bridges is like, oh, like his son's telling him about Wi-Fi and he's like, oh, I invented that in 85. And it's like, go beyond Wi-Fi. Like, what is the 2010
there's
commentary?
A very weird. I think there's kind of two aspects of what you're talking about there. One is that, like, I think that they had a lot of like super cutting edge artists. Like you said, the soundtrack or the original is Wendy Carlos and all the designs are Mobius. So it's like they really had the top artists working at
Incredible.
The time, which is why it looks and I think sounds so much more interesting. Not that like Daft Punk is interesting and there's a couple of great tracks, but I think a lot of people would say that this is kind of the worst Daft Punk album because it's just trying to do movie music. But the other weird thing, like you say, is a lot of people do comment that it loses the track of what a computer is like in the modern era altogether. Mm-hmm. Like, it's weird that it's old. And the other weird thing is, like, the original is about video games. And this one is really barely about video games, and it doesn't take into account what modern video games are like. And also, the other thing that kept Tron alive, for the most part, is video game adaptations. There was a great arcade game.
That's a great point.
And there was, before, what kind of got interest back is there's this video game, Tron 2.0, which literally involves, being on the internet. And, like, you know, you have to fight a virus that an evil company has put in the computer. And it's like, you almost should have just adapted after that, because it at least accounts for everything.
Yeah. I get, though, why, like I was saying this earlier when we were just talking offline, like, if you were 5 years old and you saw this film, I do get why Tron Legacy has a cult following. I'm not defending it. I looked forward to watching this again, even though I knew I disliked it intensely the first time I saw it. There's something about the visuals that pull me in. Even if they're empty, it's like empty calories, I kind of don't care. Like, I think if you could watch this super high or like maybe that's the way to go about it, but not for kids, not for 5 years. But I get why there's a cult following of kids who grew up with this as their Tron. In the same way in 82, kids who grew up with 82 Tron started adopting it as, you know, a forgotten Disney cult classic.
And I think that,
I do see
it. I think that that's fine. What I don't get is there's like a real Christopher Nolan bro people that think that this is like so aesthetically beautiful. And
I didn't realize
that. I don't
that.
Get okay. that. I think that there's people that just think this is a good movie, which I don't agree
it's
with.
Not.
No. It's not. By any reason.
But Tron,
thing...
Tron isn't either from 82.
Yeah,
I'm defending
I would say,
Tron 82,
I would,
but it's not a good movie.
I
love it.
I mean, there's a reason why The Simpsons say, hey, did you ever see that boring movie, Tron? But I do think it's also, Tron is also much more, if you want to get stoned and watch a movie, original Tron is much better.
But I think what's interesting is they didn't know, even when they went to market this, why they were remaking Tron. Like, I think that's part of the thing is like, we have this IP. Let's see if we can make something with it. Because even when they announced it, they were like, we know everybody knows Tron for like the visuals, but why people really love it is for the story. And it's like, name one single character from that movie. Like, go right ahead.
Yeah. And it's then, almost like Disney was lost in 82 and Disney was lost in 2010. Yeah. If you look at those as parallel tracks, I actually think Disney in 2010 is going through the same identity crisis that it was in 82. It's so, and they don't, you know, this is 12 years out. We now can reflect back. They didn't know it at the time because, you know, the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise was their number one entity. It was dying. They had nothing. Yeah. They had nothing.
It's also a film that for me feels so, trying so hard to be cool. Right? Like, is this anti-corporate? Is this anti-technology? Yeah. Why is there is an LGBTQ character, but of course they're the turncoat, you know? And I think the other, the biggest issue I have is with the way the women are treated in this, because the original Tron, she is dressed the same as everybody else is. She plays the game the same way everybody else does. Like, there is no differentiation between like the female and male characters.
A woman outside who is a significant programmer. Like, there's a third character who is a woman who just, she's erased.
I could be wrong, but I don't think there's a single female board member in the beginning of the film.
Not.
Maybe there's one or two, but like it's this 2010 out of context. Like, of course there should be women treated more three-dimensionally. but Olivia Wilde, you know, she's got this Louise Brooks haircut that's like asymmetrical. It's just so ironic too that she would be in a film like this. And I think watching some of the interviews she did, she was really doing her best to promote it. She'd be in a film like this with such a one-dimensional character and then become, I think, a very important vanguard female director for, like, our current generation. Maybe that's part of this.
I think it's part of the origin story. Yeah, because I think she, if you look, it's very interesting because you're kind of like, well, this is kind of her big coming out. And you're like, no, because she had a lot of what should have been her launch, but it was always kind of bad projects. So I think that I truly do think she became a director because she was tired, even though she doesn't often direct herself, except for, I think, that movie coming out. But
the current one, yes.
She, I don't know.
But there's also a way they're introducing these women characters and these female characters, which is paralleled in the Marvel movies.
Crazy.
Like, you think about the introduction of Black Widow, where the camera every single time is on her ass,
boobs,
right?
Ass.
That's what boobs, ass, identity.
She's got that crazy porn wig in the first movie, too.
Exactly. They do the exact same thing here, right? Where it's
when
focusing on her body parts.
Sarcophaguses that have boobs. Like, it's this movie is actually nuts. And I do like that a lot of people are like, if this was made 2 years later, Olivia Wilde would be his daughter. And like, it would be a girl. Like, it is kind of weird that it's such a specific moment in time where there's not a lot of like characters of color. There is not a lot of women. Like, the other thing, that there just aren't a lot of women at all. Like, when I think even when he's in the arena in the old one, he's fighting women now and again. Like, some of the programs are women, you know.
But there's some interesting stuff going on, like, in terms of technology at this time that I kind of wish they'd gone on to. Like, this is the exact same year that they put Mark Zuckerberg as the person of the year for Time magazine. And they kind of presented him as like the savior of the digital age. And he was a semi-Buddhist. He wasn't interested in money. He loved being around people.
Such a nice guy.
Exactly. Yes. His dream, and they quoted him, his dream was to turn the lonely antisocial world of random chance into a friendly world, a serendipitous world, which is like, why didn't you focus on something about a character like that who turns evil, which is inevitable, or like is trying to do that with all their best interests, you know,
needed,
and then it turns on him.
The Social Network, I guess. to tell us this guy's actually an asshole.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, just coming back to your comment, Cam, about how it's a lot of the Nolan bros who have adopted this as like a great film, and I call them neckbeard cinema bros. But I think there is a certain element of like incel 4chan, like love potentially of this kind of story. It's really, it's almost like it was made in the 1930s, except it's incredibly cutting edge in its technology. That I could see really appealing to the Zuckerberg, you know, crowd. Very disenfranchised white men.
Yes. But what they've clicked into here, from my understanding, is the mythos of Steve Jobs at the time. Because Steve Jobs, of course, as many people don't know, in the 80s, he lost Apple. They fired him. And then they were failing, so they brought him back, and he's the one who brought them back with, like, everything needs to be simple, and then he got this, like, mythos of being this infallible God. That's kind of what they're trying to do with him and Clue and Kevin Flynn. Like, it's supposed to be both sides of the same, which I get.
It makes sense,
more
too,
of that. More
of that. He's got that tech bro, like, Buddhism. Like, it's all, there's this weird Buddhism feminism thing that barely works throughout about sacrificing
yourself.
Well, he's
just the dude. Like, yeah. It's Jeff Bridges, but he's just the dude.
Yes.
Clue figures if I can be in.
He can be out.
With my disc, it's possible.
And then what?
Game over. The guy doesn't dig imperfection.
Talks about like his buzz and like his aura, like it's ridiculous.
It's obviously, I mean, he just won the Oscar, so it's obvious because that's the other thing is like Bruce,
is that for Crazy Heart?
Yeah, for Crazy Heart. Yeah. Like Bruce Boxleitner is kind of sort of the main character of like Tron is the main character of Tron, Wild Thing, and Tron is in this but barely because they don't want to spend money on de-aging Bruce Boxleitner, I think. So he mostly has
a
helmet
on. Great.
He does look great.
You don't need to de-age
just
him.
Put makeup
fantastic
on. Yeah, yeah.
In this film.
And he looks like himself. He's one of those people that aged kind of just, yeah, like stretch his skin back with some tape and he'll be young again. But yeah, so that's kind of a weird aspect too. But Jeff Bridges takes over. And I think Jeff Bridges, you know, he's also in Iron Man as like an evil tech person. So I don't know. It's weird. I think that they misuse almost all the actors because it's like, yeah, there's a lot of the humor is missing in this movie. And I think Olivia Wilde can be quite funny. And Michael Sheen is obviously making it work with humor. I think Garrett Hedlund is one of those unfortunate guys where it's like he's incredibly handsome, but he's much better as a character actor that kind of shows up and steals a scene or two. And he's better as like a rat faced, sweaty, you know, long hair creep, not the fresh faced man.
Oh, that Michael Sheen character.
To Michael Sheen's credit, he is finding jokes where there are no jokes. Mm-hmm. He is bringing personality where there is no personality.
Doing a little Charlie Chaplin walk with his cane.
It's wonderful.
The son of Flynn. Of all the innumerable possibilities, he has to walk into mine. Libations for everybody!
He was a big fan of Tron, and his agent was like, do not go into that meeting with Disney and say you're a big fan of Tron because they're going to pay you less. Make them work for it. Like, he was like, I will do this for free.
Yeah.
Tron was his number one film, which I'm like, good for him because he owns this film because he's the most memorable part.
He shows up and you feel like you're breathing again.
This is the era of Michael Sheen also. Like, the weird thing is you're like, well, you know, Jeff Bridges was coming off this Oscar boom. And it's like, Michael Sheen uses Oscar boom to be like, I'm going to be in Underworld and Twilight and 30 Rock. Like, I'm going to play Wesley Snipes in 30
apparently.
Rock. Like, yeah, he just does whatever. And he also managed to, like, he plays a bad vampire in, like, 9 movies. But you're still always like, fuck yes, Michael Sheen is the bad vampire. I want to see this.
All right, something we should talk about here before we go anywhere. I know we're giving him the love. This, of course, was retooled to be in 3D because of the giant 3D boom. And we should get into that just for a second because it's something very unique to like 2009, 2010, 2011, gone.
And I think that's where probably Joseph Kosinski shines too, because he has this background. He's actually still an adjunct professor of architecture, which is interesting. So I think
that's
really, I wish it came across more here. I don't know. I mean, the structures are cool and stuff because it sounds like he was very hands-on in the special effects, which is very unusual. So yeah, I mean, there's care to it for sure. It has a vision. But yeah, so I think there's something interesting there. And I bet you, like you say, Alicia, that it was very, I can't remember if I saw this in theaters or not, but I bet it was pretty breathtaking.
Yeah, it was. I think it was more breathtaking if you saw it not in 3D because of the reasons I kind of mentioned before, that especially that era of 2010, you would have to sacrifice the colors to see it in 3D. So it looked like very gray and very dim. True of Pixar, I remember seeing Up in 3D and then seeing it the next day in non-3D and was like, wow, what a disservice. Yeah. This bullshit technology is doing to cinema. You know, and this is also the era where Cineplexes realized that they could like not put their bulb on the full volume and then that they would save money. So you're just seeing this like darkened version of the film. Yeah, if Tron Legacy were back in cinemas, like in a let's say a TIFF light box, something where I know that bulb is the right level, I would go because I do think this is an experience. And I don't know when I'm ever going to get a chance to see that 70 print of Tron again.
Oh, request it at your local 70 millimeter cinema, I suppose. Your local Cinesphere or what have you.
I think what's so interesting to me is that they looked at Avatar, because Avatar is what started the 3D boom. And they said, you know what people loved about this movie? The 3D. Like, that's really what made this movie the mega hit.
But I mean,
was.
It's also nuts that this one was post-create, like that's nuts to me. Like, why was this not like Avatar? created with three dimensions.
Why wouldn't they do this in the beginning?
And I mean, that's kind of what original Tron was created as, again, right? Like, and the interesting thing is, like, I don't want to give this too much flack for not pushing technology, because I do feel like at the time that de-aged Jeff Bridges, as uncanny as it can feel, was amazing. Like, that was, we hadn't seen that. We're now pretty used to
de-aging. That's what they sold it on at Comic-Con.
You'd seen the opposite with Benjamin Button.
True. So, like, and better, like, probably.
So it was like, and it's the same, it's the same company that did it.
Yeah. That's how they introduced, that's how they announced the movie at Comic-Con, was they just showed a quick little trailer of the car rolling up and him getting out, and he was DH Jeff Bridges. People were like, oh my God.
You can look it up. It's called TR2N. You can Google that on YouTube. It's a different special clip they made to sell it. And the other funny thing is, again, they sold it. And they're like, Kaczynski, you're on. And he's like, my what? Like, they hadn't written. He admits, he actually is very candid about it. And it's very interesting because he admits, they hadn't had a script. They sold it literally on that trailer. And then when people went nuts, they were like, okay. And like, Jeff Bridges apparently really loved Tron and was really excited to do another Tron. But yeah, he kind of says, I don't know. And then he also says that, like, will there ever be another one? Because like you said, Becky, this made a lot of money. And it had a lot of merch. And again, it had more, it had cartoon spinoffs. It had more video games, which apparently aren't as good as Tron 2.0. But then he's also like, Joseph Kaczynski is like, this was, like you were saying, Alicia, this was a time where, you know, Disney's always obsessed with intellectual property, but this was all they had. They were going back and forth between two failure films, Black Hole and Tron. And and then so now he's like, now they have so much intellectual property. Why the hell would they ever go back to Tron?
I mean, at least they didn't reboot a live action as a Black Cauldron.
Oh, you know what? Alicia,
if you do that, I'm there. Are they doing
it? As a childhood fan of the Criterion Chronicles, you're always like, why hasn't anyone taken a swing at this? And it's because Disney's sitting on it because they know. It could be something.
I would do it.
Get Tim Burton to direct that. That is a real 360. Right there.
Not that I'm telling people that they need to experience movies in like other forms, but all I'm saying.
Oh, but I did just say that earlier.
That is true. There is a roller coaster in Shanghai Disney, and there's about to be one in a Disney World based on Tron that is extremely cool. And if you go on YouTube, you can see it. I'm not saying give Disney your money and go to Disney World. It's a very expensive, cost prohibitive thing, but it is extremely neat to see what they're.
I've never been to World. Growing up in Southern California, I lived at Land. But I would probably go to World just for what I know about that Tron coaster in Shanghai. It's considered like in the top 10 in terms of like both thrilling coasters and what it does, but visuals and how it's designed. It's like next. Like
I'll say
world,
if any of you out there are broke like me and interested in these rides, there's quite often ride through videos that are really good. I've done the Shanghai Beauty and the Beast one is amazing too.
Have you seen the Shanghai Pirates of the Caribbean?
No.
They have
the crazy animatronics.
Oh, it's not just the animatronics. There's like screen animation. You go underwater with the galleons and like it's nuts, man.
I don't like watching those because I want to be so surprised
when are you going to Shanghai?
Not anytime soon, but when I went to Euro Disney, I mean, I should say Disneyland Paris. It's not called Euro Disney. They had Captain EO, and I had never seen Captain EO. And I was like, this is, oh my God, Angelica Houston's in Captain EO? Like, I had no idea. Like, it's very exciting.
Well, speaking of other thrills, we should move on to our next film. It's Predators. Does it kill us? We're going to find out after the break. As we mentioned previously, there were a couple of franchise remakes slash reboot attempts in 2010 that failed to take off. The Wolfman, Nightmare on Elm Street, and The Karate Kid all arrived and left with little steam on the backs of the box office giants behind them. The difficulty of the reboot, or in this case, a story that occurs in the same universe, is that audiences have certain expectations of what's going to happen, and it's up to the filmmaker slash studio to simultaneously play into those expectations while upping the ante to make this film modern and edgy. Well, 2010's Predators does exactly that. Katana battles anyone, and it made another ton of money. All the surviving cast members and the filmmakers wanted to make a sequel. They still do. However, we're going to get into that. Alicia, you love Predators. You love it so much.
I do. And I'm not saying it's like, I don't think it's a phenomenally great film. I just think very much unlike Tron, it was written directed and produced by people who live and breathe that original Predator film from 87. Yeah. And I think to some extent the sequel, which is very good in my eyes, from 1990, they love this franchise. They love it. They respect it. And I think they got it really right on a very low budget. They really got the mythology right. And interestingly enough, and I think maybe some people would disagree with me, sort of righted some wrongs that had happened to the Predator mythology through the AVP, which are coming before it. You have Alien versus Predator, and then Alien versus Predator Requiem is like 2007, I think. And I actually love AVP. Like, I'm not that person who hates AVP, but a lot of people do. This is as true to the original 87 Schwarzenegger as I think you can get while still being cutting edge and relevant for a 2010 audience. It's the casting is interesting at times, maybe questionable, and then at other times, if we're talking about Danny Trejo, perfect, and Walton Goggins, who this is an early role for Walton Goggins, who might have been unjustified at this point.
Maybe.
But
I
think so.
Maybe not known as he is now as the Righteous Gemstones.
And, as you know, this as character we go in, and everything. Yeah.
Exactly. I do want to say as we go in, Danny Trejo is in this movie because he knew there was a script going around that was written by with Robert Rodriguez that was doing it. He had been doing Machete, and apparently in the script it says a Danny Trejo type, and he called him up and was like, I hear you got a script with a Danny Trejo type. Guess what? I'm a Danny Trejo type.
So good. So,
yeah, I think it's a spoiler. He gets killed off quite early. It's a very gruesome but well done scene in horror. Yeah. I think it's brilliant. But I'm sure maybe even Rodriguez was like, oh, he's not going to take this if he's only in the first 15 minutes of the film. But I think he's one of the most memorable parts
and
of the film.
It also works because he has such a distinct voice. Mm.
Yeah. He's also a real life convict, and that's what he's playing in this. And he's very open about that and his life in prison. And so it just kind of, it's very believable. But I will get into the plot. Not that it matters too much, but we are just dropped literally into the story because the opening shot is Adrian Brody plummeting in the sky. Like, no idea who he's been thrown out of an airplane. He lands in a jungle, doesn't know where he is. And then another guy plummets from the sky. And there are parachutes. They see a guy in a parachute that didn't make it, but his body's chute didn't open. And they're landing on this planet. Well, at the point, they think it's Earth, but spoiler, it's not. And it's a group of people that are like either mercenaries, notorious like killers that have been in prison, and all like very effective killers, and Topher Grace from that 70s show. So right away, they're like, who? He's a doctor, apparently.
This is also his Miley Cyrus moment, right? Because he's doing Venom in Spider-Man 3. Like, they're trying to get him out of that. Tom Foreman? I don't remember the kid's name. But yeah, that 70s
Foreman.
Show.
Eric. You know, and this is a film called Predators, which is both a throwback to the fact that the second film was called Aliens in the Alien franchise, and all it was more of them. Not all. I mean, Aliens is a different film, and I love it. But, like, this is, I think, in a way where Predator 2, which takes place in New York City with Danny Glover, and I love that film. Oh, no, I'm sorry, Los Angeles, not New York City, where the Predators come to Earth to hunt. And, it, you know, I do think it's great, but this is kind of more what the traditional sequel to the 87 Predator should be. And they have, you know, they eventually figure out that they are not on Earth. They figure out that planes or ships are dropping other alien life forms to hunt them, and also other alien life forms like themselves are being hunted. There's a lot of throwbacks here. My favorite throwback, which we have a film fact or an on film on Predator on our YouTube page for Hollywood Suite, maybe a film fact about how the original Predator was Jean-Claude Van Damme for like 2 weeks of the initial filming in 87 in the jungle with John McTiernan, JCVD, and he had no Hollywood roles. And that at that time, the creature looked very different. It was almost like a giant anteater. And so in one of the alien life forms that they encounter, it's that creature. It's like there's so many Easter eggs that we haven't said the director's name, Nimrod Intel, who I think is incredibly talented. He had some really interesting Hungarian films and Hollywood films prior to this. He gets it. Like, he's watching that movie Predator over and over again and really just like making this, not to the point where you're just counting the references. Like, you know, the first time I saw Predators, I didn't know that JCVD story and that creature we saw that's incredibly well done with special effects was the original Predator. It's only now that doing the research, it just works. I'm not saying this is a great film. It works really well as a B film. It came out late in the summer. My memory was it was an August release. It's not the high budget that you would expect that Fox would pump into Alien films and Predator films. It does a lot with very little. And I think it's really effective as a thriller.
I love this one as well. I think this is as close as you can get to what a legacy sequel slash reboot should do in building up the world, but giving you new people to follow and but not changing anything up too much. So you're like, no, that's not how this works. So still like being cool with everybody and giving you new people to root for. And also, I mean, I understand most of the people of color die here, but like this is a pretty diverse cast, which I'm extremely pleased with.
I love Alice. Alice Braga's in it. And amazing. She's really in the tradition of that very strong female character in the original Predator. She's sort of the 2010 version of that. And Adrian Brody as an action star is an interesting choice. I think he works. I think much like Nimrod Antel and Robert Rodriguez, he loves Predator. So he was trying to like, apparently he was trying to like sneak in Arnold Schwarzenegger one-liners and like Antel was like, you can't do that. You're Adrian Brody. Like you're not.
And he was weirdly jacked at the time too. That was like a weird thing.
He's jacked in a way where you're like, this isn't jacked in a way I don't believe this man who does this job would be jacked. He looks appropriately jacked for what his profession
would
be.
Like, he's famous for being the skinniest skeletal man, so he's as jacked as that skinny skeletal man can be. And I also think it was a time where we didn't really have the beefy action stars, you know? They kind of went away for a while.
How much of what we are seeing in 2010 is reactionary to Batman Begins being what it was, right? And this is now how we do origin stories. This is how we play our heroes. Because, I mean, you cannot tell me Christian Bale's voice isn't coming out of Adrian Brody's
especially
mouth.
Towards
like,
the
100%
end.
That's what he's doing.
Where are you going?
To high ground.
We need to stick together.
Then you should follow me.
It gets a little too gravelly for my personal taste of like, oh, that's put on, dude. Just talk like people.
I agree with you, but I think that's all part of the B film sort of, you know, shtick. This is a film that does not pretend to be anything it isn't.
No.
And I really respect that because if you, you know, if you're listening to this episode, 2010 was a year where films pretended to be things they were not.
Yes.
And I think this film understood that it was going to be released in late summer. It understood that it was not going to be a blockbuster, that it was going to be for the fans and the, you know, the dates that are going to go out at 10 p.m. and see the late show of this. And it nailed that. Nailed that. And I think I was just very excited, you know, much like Alien. And it's not that I'm not a fan of it. It's a necessary evil, but you have to keep evolving the monster, right? Like alien to aliens with a queen to a dog alien to a weird Ripley human alien to I could go on. And that happened to Predator 2 through the AVP franchise. And to some extent the second
the
Predator film.
Predator.
AVP Requiem is really bad. Even I cannot redeem that film. But
if you pretend it's not a Predator movie, it's kind of fine.
It's a great Christmas film. This is just the OG Predator from 87 in terms of the Stan Winston. It's Stan Winston, right? The effects,
It's a different crew because I believe Stan
Winston
was...
But it is the Stan Winston house.
He gets credit for designing it, but like it's him. It's the same guy. And yes, there is we find out in this film that there's warring factions of Predators. So there is another Predator that's like the Predator's Predator. That's more of a scary, like, kind of different race of Predator. I'm fine with that. As long as you give me the original guy in the rubber suit and he's super vaginal and scary and he's got the green blood and he's, you know, he's tall, but he's not like 12 feet tall. He's like 6'8". I'm good.
As this is the last episode of the season, I have to include an Ebert bitchity snippet because I've been loving them all season long. And this one, he did not like the creature designs at all. And specifically the dog creatures, he had a big issue with them existing. So his response was, here comes some really vicious warthog looking creatures. They weigh about half a ton apiece, move as fast as lions, and have so many horns and spikes sticking out of them that fornicating must have had to have been a sometime thing. Like, come on, dude. Just suspension of disbelief. Sure. No one is thinking about these creatures.
He'll be happy that Shane Black redesigned them to be different kinds of dogs in his terrible, terrible sequel.
And we don't need to talk about the Shane Black. I will say this. That is a film, much like Ishtar, that if you can watch the first 30 minutes, pretty much perfect, yes. then just leave. Yes. I actually don't believe about Ishtar.
I love Ishtar, famously one that nobody was pleased with. Like, I don't think it's one that Shane Black came out happy with.
Well, at what point did they think that autism is a superpower was going to fly?
I mean, 80s, I guess. It's the 80s again. But yeah.
I don't want to get out onto a tangent, but I was there for that premiere and oh, wow.
Speaking of reboots, so this had languished for a long time because, like, I think it's like, what, 89 for Predators 2, and then they do like 90, AVP yeah. and all that. So what's wild to me is that no one had any faith in this reboot. Like, no one ever seems to want to reboot Predator. They're like, well, guess it's time to dust off Predator. So they had Rodriguez do a treatment for this in 95. And thank God that that one didn't happen, because that one happened on the home planet of the Predators, where they had imported the Schwarzenegger character. Yes, of Dutch. Of course, I love that you know this. They imported Dutch, and Dutch was like in for gladiatorial games, and apparently like the Predators were like swigging their alien beer, and they had motorcycles.
Are you telling me you wouldn't watch that?
I would watch it, but I don't know if I would like it. I think I would sit there in awe.
I understand that, like, a lot of the bones of that script are this film, though, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, the other planet. So when they found out that Rodriguez, after, because 95 was when Rodriguez was just kind of coming out. And so when the producers who took on, I guess these producers who had done some ill were like, here, please enjoy the Predator franchise. See what you can do with it. They found out Rodriguez had written a treatment. They looked at it and said, well, we don't have the budget for this. So what can you do? And I think they had to rewrite it like 6 or 7 times so they could find something that would be okay and actually fit in the budget, which they did. Like, this is as close to perfect as you get.
I have to give Rodriguez a lot of credit because he stuck with it.
Yeah.
You know, this is the love of a franchise. Like, he didn't jump ship. He doesn't direct it, but he was very involved. And I think he personally chose Nimrod Antel, and that was a brilliant choice, because this is not a person who had done monster movies in the past or giant action films.
Amazing with violence on a budget that looks amazing. Have you seen Vacancy? Vacancy is brutal. And you compare this movie to that movie, and you're like, proof of concept.
Perfect choice of a director. And I know he went on to do a Metallica sort of concert doc, but also has elements of fiction. He's an interesting guy.
He does Stranger Things now. He's got a couple episodes of Stranger
Things. Oh, I didn't know that. That makes perfect sense.
M. Night Shyamalan show Servant, I think, is a lot him as well. But yeah, I think also Alicia and I would probably recommend a friend of the show, Brendan Ross, showed on his birthday Control, his first film, which is very cool.
Brendan loves that film.
Tough to find, but it's this very bizarre Hungarian subway action movie. That's totally cool.
Okay. I don't like to poke holes in things, but this one I have to ask you guys. How do the Predators know that Topher Grace is a serial killer?
I mean, I think that
was he in jail maybe, or like in a psychiatric ward?
I think he was just out doing.
I don't think so.
If I am to believe my various Predator media, your Batman's versus Predator, for instance, that I think that the Predators are implanted a bit on Earth, also just like watching for the best people. Yeah, I do recommend, if anybody has 80s comics, to dig up the old Batman versus Predator. It's pretty good. It has a lot of good Predator lore. Superman versus Aliens, not so good.
Do you still have those copies?
Yeah, probably somewhere, but I'd have to go to Edmonton.
Are they at your mom and dad's house? Can you go get them next time?
Yeah, I wonder if I have the full series, but it was good.
Because I will take those off your hands or borrow them.
There's probably a new put together of it, because I think it was quite respected.
Yeah, like a compendium.
Yeah, it looked beautiful too. And it was a great, you know, Batman versus Predator. And of course, do the Predators respect Batman, or is he the greatest prey? I don't know.
That's actually a good question. If you are pairing up any of these, that one makes more sense than Punisher versus Archie.
Yes.
So I will give them that.
I'm sure Punisher fought the Predator. They all fought the Predator.
They must have.
But it's, I think for the most part, it's the thought that they are really on Earth all the time, kind of waiting and watching and trying to find the Dutch.
Yeah. Like, AVP has that because the Mayan, Incan, Aztec culture are, the gods are actually Predator, which kind of, let's not get into the indigenous aspect of AVP, because I think it's really problematic for 2003.
Yes. Also, that having been said, we are recording this before Prey comes out, so none of us have seen Prey.
I am so excited, but I'm also reminding myself of how excited I was for AVP Requiem in that I brought my family to it on Christmas Day, which was the day that it opened.
Sure. I mean, yep. The thing with both.
I got to keep my expectations in check. However, I think the consensus at this time before it's premiered is
generally
solid.
Positive. Yeah. I will say, too, that the thing I always remind people when you're talking about Alien and Predator as IP is like, these are franchises that have one to two great movies, and then it's up to you, user. What do you enjoy? Because I would say that this is the best Predator sequel by quite a bit. Yeah. Though I think 2 is beautifully shot and has a great performance by Danny Glover and interesting lore.
2's cool.
But it's kind of a weird mess. And it's also kind of, when you were talking about some like upsetting, like it's kind of upsettingly racist in weird ways. Mm-hmm. Even though it stars a black actor.
It's very anti-drug.
Yes,
I mean, the Predator does come and string up a bunch of drug dealers that are pushing smack to children.
A bunch of Jamaican gangsters.
Deeply, deeply racist. Yeah. Where it's like, Danny Glover is fighting them, so there's that.
There are arguments that Predator, I don't want to get too into the weeds here, but like, Predator has the dreads. There's some elements there.
Yeah, it was Stan Winston, I believe. Rastafarian warrior is what he's based on.
I think you're right, Cam. Like, I always will defend that a Predator film is fun, even when they anger me, like
fine.
The Predator did. There are some that are exceptional. I think this is one of them. And I really hope Prey is exceptional. I think the idea of combining Comanche, like, history and the Predator mythology. And then I think I read that they're going to put a Comanche subtitled version available, which is pretty damn cool.
I think it's even a completely dead language that is that they brought in a language person. Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's, it's cool. And I mean, that's the other thing with Predator and Alien is that, like, it's like, how can you not be constantly making sequels to this? Like, you can just throw a Predator in anywhere and it works.
Let's get into that then. Why didn't this get a sequel? Mm-hmm. Because for me, this made more than enough on top of the minuscule budget
money.
That it made.
Yeah,
it made a lot of money. Everybody wanted to do it. It was, I mean, very few people survived this, but like Brody was back in. Everybody was back in for this. So it's weird to me that they didn't. They even have the whole thing mapped out. The producers loved the idea of what the sequel was going to be. Do you guys know what the sequel was going to do?
No.
You ready for this?
Oh,
man. It's real good. Okay, so the new movie opens up with more drops happening and more aliens showing up. And just as one of the super predators is going to kill the new people, both Royce and Isabel pop out and they're like, welcome to the resistance. So now they're running this whole thing. That's just act one. Act two is they figure out how to get onto the ship. One of them is captured and then it becomes Die Hard on a predator ship.
Or Air Force One, if you will.
Sure.
Exactly.
Yes.
But I would watch the hell out of that. I'm like, that's another, like, the budget's not astronomical. You're seeing what you came to see, and you've got two people that you already know what the tricks are, and just watch them get better, right?
I think
that's interesting.
Sadly, if you look at 2010 Fox, they probably at that point know they're poising themselves for a massive sale to Disney or Viacom or probably not Amazon at that point. And I think if you look at the kinds of films they banked and the kinds of franchises that they ensured the longevity of, it was all just to poise it for a sale.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and
which is why you're seeing Prey now.
They also do say that essentially while they were kind of developing it and it was going back and forth, that the Shane Black one came up and just kind of took the thunder.
Yeah.
And I also think stuff like Adrian Brody kind of never, this is kind of his last bite at the apple of being an action star, because he had King Kong and stuff too, but
good point. So, 2005.
He just kind of never clicked, and I think he's also kind of a tough person to work with that people don't like necessarily. I know he's still around, but I know that
he's the Wes Anderson guy.
Yeah, he's Wes, and I think he's on TV a lot. But,
he does miniseries.
I will say,
like,
though, there's a lot of hope. Like, the fact that Disney just now, with having purchased Fox, is doing Prey. Maybe this is going to be where we see the sequel. Like, if Prey does well, and I don't know how things do well when they're just on Hulu.
Yeah.
But, you know, if this does well, then and we know that Cam brought up earlier, there's an Alien television series coming. Yeah. Like, we could see, maybe not this exact script for Predators, but I could see them. I mean, especially Nimrod and Tel being so good at television right now with Stranger Things, bring him back. Maybe like revise the script in a couple years, see what happens.
Well, Nimrod Antel has a fantastic expression of delight and excitement, which is, that was pancakes. And I think we end with the fact that this movie is pancakes. Yeah. And so with the end of this movie also comes the end of season 4. This was one heck of a ride, guys.
It was.
It's true.
It's like a free-for-all out of a predator ship.
Yeah. Yes.
We had some really amazing guests, but we also had some really amazing movies that we got to watch with those guests. And of course, as we always end the season, what was the one movie that you guys would really recommend people go back to and go check out if they haven't seen it yet? Cam, let's start with you. You look confident.
Sure, yeah. You know what? I think that I was very impressed by Scream Blackula Scream, which I think was I always told that was considered a, you know, Blackula's good, Scream, Blackula's Scream is bad. But I was really interested in it, and it made me go back and rewatch Blackula. Those are just a kind of a great, much deeper concept and franchise than I had expected. That would probably be mine.
How about for you, Alicia?
I think I'd go back to our Kirsten Dunst episode because Dick really stood out for me. I'm not gonna make a joke.
It's a gift that keeps on giving. Yeah,
it was such a surprise to see that again and how effervescent and politically astute it was for 1999. And then otherwise, I'd say if I could have a second one, Canadian Heavenly Bodies. Just really fun. The Japanese version of the vinyl soundtrack arrived recently in the mail, and I've been playing that pretty hard. And that was a really, really fun episode to do with.
That was with Brendan.
Yeah. What's the other film, though? The one with,
Perfect.
Perfect. Perfect was pretty great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, I was going to say, like, I had discovered Perfect earlier because, Alicia, you had said you need to see this is actually really good, and you were, in fact, correct. Yeah. So I won't choose Perfect. But I will say that discovering Jesus Christ Superstar, I played that soundtrack a lot later. I went back, I watched different versions of all the different people who are playing them. I liked that a lot, more than I thought I would. And that Anthony Oliveira conversation I found extremely enlightening. Sure. So
are you Christian now?
Lot.
Did you convert to Catholicism?
No, but I do have thoughts on the Bible, which is, I think, all anyone can ask for. All right, and let's bring this season to a close. But don't worry, we're going to be back in a few weeks, specifically April 4th. So if you're not subscribed to the show yet, go ahead and subscribe now so that you know when the show is dropping. And we're going to be looking at 1977, 1988, 1991, and 2002. All very good years for film. You're not going to want to miss it. So we'll see you then. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies and the series that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagné. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.